the Schoenberg Center's live webcast throughout the planet, Understanding Black Liberation Theology, a 40-year retrospective, is about to get underway. And to make that happen, please welcome once again not only our panelists, but the gentleman who will open the program, the Reverend Dr. M. William Howard, Jr.
Good evening, everyone. We welcome you here this evening, and we want to thank the Schoenberg Center for bringing us together, presenting this evening as some of the preeminent voices, scholars, writers on the subject of Black liberation theology, including, of course, Dr. James Cohn, whose groundbreaking work of almost four decades ago, Black Theology and Black Power, helped to codify and give voice to our understanding of the Christian gospel as a source of identity, courage, and strength to struggle against human oppression. This is an extraordinary opportunity for this community to hear a fresh restatement of the precepts of Black theology, and to renew, I hope, this movement at a time when the prosperity gospel has taken hold and when African people are today struggling to overcome challenges we thought at one time we had overcome. So again, I welcome you and take great delight in welcoming now for opening reflections to this podium, the Pastor Emeritus of the Riverside Church, Dr. James Forbes.
Brothers and sisters, how good and how pleasant it is for brothers and sisters to dwell together. I think we are here tonight because we have some sense that if we do not remember where we came from, we will have very little choice in regards to where we will be headed and where we will finally end up. What a joy it is to have the privilege just to open up for this panel of distinguished persons who have kept alive a tradition, but who also gave birth to it in its academic expression, drawing upon the history of many mothers and fathers who longed for what they did not see. And we see it dimly, but not yet clearly. So I thought the best way to start is to say that you really will not understand what is spoken tonight unless you have some sense of the importance of context for any endeavor. So here we are, back to 1968. Dr. King is assassinated. 1969, James Forman presents at the Riverside Church the Black Manifesto. It leaves questions. Who will replace Dr. King? But in regards to the Black Manifesto, I was in Richmond at the time, and I remember the day after he presented his paper at the Riverside Church, it was in the news, we met for an interracial gathering at First Baptist Church, Monument and Boulevard. And they wrestled, black and white, and Dr. Ransom left to go to the bathroom as the white brethren were saying, you know, this manifesto sounds Marxist in its name. And they hemmed and they hawed. As he went to the bathroom, he says, you know, our white brothers have a whole lot of trouble at the mourner's bench. But anyway, shortly after 68, 69, it was my privilege to go to my own alma mater, Howard University, where there was a conference on Black theology. I was expecting to see older persons who had been around doing theology, but I met for the first time a young professor, as young as I was, and here he was blazing a brand new trail with respect to theology. What an exhilarating moment it was in Rankin Chapel where Dr. Cone addressed us. And Vincent Harding also brought his message that day. I had a responsibility, Dr. Cone, to preach a sermon somewhere in the connection, and my sermon was entitled, How to Be Black and a Christian Too. After listening to you, I understood how it could be done. But anyway, out came this book. The color, red and black, with a black cross and red for the blood and for liberation, splattered against the background of whiteness. There's a message in the artistry here. But many of you did not know that this book, not the first one, but this one was the but distance reflection on what had been said in the first one. It was a part of the C. Eric Lincoln series in Black Religion. And what I thought I'd do, rather than give words of my own, is to set a context. And if you hear from Dr. C. Eric Lincoln's book, Coming Through the Fire, Surviving Race and Place in America, you'll be ready for this conversation. So I'm going to read from it. It's more eloquent and tells what the soil was in which these seeds began to spring up. C. Eric Lincoln explains that in order to get money for tuition to go to school, which was $27 a year, the family had had hardships, and the only way he could get money was to go and glean cotton after everybody else had finished with the field. So he gleaned for cotton. And he says, early next morning, I put the sack of cotton on a wheelbarrow and pushed it into town to the gin. The manager of the gin was a tall, red-faced man who always wore a cigar stub plugged in the corner of his mouth. I had seen him before when I had gone there with Grandpa, but I had never spoken to him. I did not know his name, but he was standing in the doorway of his office as I pushed the wheelbarrow upon the platform. What you got there, boy? He asked as he wobbled the cigar stub from corner to corner of his small tobacco-stained mouth. I've got some cotton I'd like to sell, I said. You steal it, nigger? When I assured him I did not, he ordered me, put it on the scales. I hung the bag on the long iron balance that is a symbol of cotton country all over the South. The white man adjusted the pea, and when the balance was struck, I could see that the bag of cotton weighed exactly 41 pounds. Cotton lint was selling at 9 cents a pound. Allowing a pound for the bag, I made the calculation that I would receive $3.60. I would use part of the money to buy something to take home for breakfast. The rest would go for books and tuition. My musings were interrupted by the white man's order to dump the cotton into a bin he pointed out to me. I did so. When I emptied the bag, I rolled it carefully and followed the white man upstairs into his office to be paid. I was very proud to be taking home some money so that my family could eat again. Suddenly, I was the man of the house. Mom Matt would be proud of me. The white man sat down behind a battered old desk and busied himself with some papers. I waited with carefully controlled impatience, for I wanted very much to be able to get on home in time to go to the store for Mama Matt before going to school. At last, the man looked up as if he were surprised to see anyone standing there. He seemed very annoyed, and the cigar stump wobbled back and forth around his mouth like a bottle stopper on a trout line. What you want, boy? He asked in the suspicious, measured tone of someone about to make trouble. I told him that I was waiting to be paid for my cotton. What you mean, you're waiting to get money, he asked. Boy, I thought I done paid you. His cold blue eyes glinted in the early morning light. When I showed no sign of leaving, he felt around in his pocket and flipped a coin in my direction. Instinctively, I caught it. It was a quarter. The white man again busied himself among the papers on his desk. He was oblivious of my presence as anyone. I was standing there in front of him, close enough to touch him, but suddenly I felt as though I did not exist at all. And at that moment, I did not want to exist. I wanted to disintegrate, to wither away in the nothingness he communicated that I was. I was ashamed, humiliated, and I was afraid. Somehow I knew that I had unwittingly stepped across a boundary. I tried to move. Perhaps if I could move my feet, I could somehow pass into nothingness. I covered to save myself from that catastrophe. Finally, I stumbled out of the office on leaden feet. But by the time I had reached the ground, my feet wouldn't go any further. I turned and forced myself back up the stairs into the office. "Excuse me, sir," I said, waiting to see if anyone was listening. "Excuse me, but I think you must have made a mistake." I had 40 pounds of cotton, and that was just a quarter you gave me. Suddenly, there was an awesome silence, a dreadful eternity in which there was absolutely no sound at all anywhere. The world had simply stopped moving, stopped existing. And then, just as quickly, I could hear again, "Just wait a minute," the gin man said very slowly and carefully. "Just a minute." He got up and slouched to the door of his office and bolted it. Then he came and planted himself in front of me like some glowering colossus from hell. "Now, nigger," he demanded with the greasy unction of an executioner, "what's that you said? I done made a mistake? That's what you said? Well, I'll just be goddamned and son of a bitch to boot. Nigger gonna come right here in my office and gonna call me a liar right here in my face." The truth is that I had no intention of such a gross breach of manners as calling any adult a liar. Grandma would not have stood for that even if I had survived it. At the moment, I was only thinking about the books I needed to get back in school and of something for Mom Matt and Papa to eat until Mama Matt got her wash money on the weekend. But because it was true that I was proud to have a quick mind with figures, I think something I had actually expected the gin man to be pleased with, I was able to settle the matter so quickly. Now, as it turned out, that quick mind my teacher applauded and my grandmother expected was about to cost me my life. Nor was my premonition of impending catastrophe merely the excess of boyish imagination. The precedents were all around me as evidence of daily experience, and a fleeting recollection of a prayer in a poem by Langston Hughes flooded into my consciousness. "Oh, Lord, if you can save me from this man, don't let him make a pup out of me." But the Lord, he was not quick, and the man raised up his stick, and he beat the living hell out of me. The angry white man stood down, looking down on me, his red bony fist tightly balled and hanging tense at his side. He was tall, the tallest man I ever saw, and I felt so very small at 13 years old. "Now, nigga, I want you to tell me one more time what you said to me so as I can be sure I done got it right." I wanted desperately to apologize or to at least find some more acceptable words to tell the man what he owed me, but no other words would come. There were no other words, and so I heard myself explaining. "You see, sir, I had 40 pounds of cotton, not counting the croaker sack. I brought that in with me. I see on the wall there that your price is 9 cents a pound. That comes to $3.60 for the 40 pounds, sir, but you gave me a quarter. And you say I done made a mistake? Near as I can figure it out, you done called me a liar." The man flushed red to the base of his neck. He spat out the cigar stub, and his lips jerked and sputtered wordlessly, tobacco juice oozing from the corner of his mouth. Suddenly, I saw his red, bony fist come up at me, but I was too paralyzed with fear to move.
His first blow to my chin lifted me off the floor and crumpled me at his feet. Then he began to rhythmically stomp my head and kick me in the face and stomach with his heavy brogan. Each kick was punctuated with an oath. "A goddamn nigger," he complained. "A coming in here gonna teach me how to count cotton money. A goddamn black ass nigger gonna tell me I done made a mistake. Ignorant ass nigger gonna try to count behind a white man. Boy, you listen and you listen good. Ain't no nigger can count behind a white man. God ain't made no such nigger yet, and God ain't gonna never make such a nigger, because ain't no such a nigger can be made, and don't you forget it." Last paragraph. That lesson in racial etiquette cost me a tooth, a bloated, bloody face, a ruptured stomach, and a mouth full of scar tissue. The lesson was indelible. Ain't no nigger can count behind a white man. But he was wrong. A person who had been called nigger turned out to be a theologian who challenged the assumption of Western theology, indicating that if you got a mind, you can think. And if you think, everybody counts the same, and especially those who've been counted out. Since God's on their side, they're going to count a whole lot. And the rest is almost 40 years history.
Closing remarks at the conclusion of our time together, but if I may just share with you the ground rules. We're going to ask each of our presenters to speak for a while, and once they have made a presentation, we'll have them talk among themselves a bit, and of course invite those of you in the audience who would like to ask questions or make comments to speak. With that in mind, I'd like to ask Dr. James Cone to begin. Of course, Dr. Cone is the Charles A. Briggs Distinguished Professor at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York. Dr. Cone.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here tonight. Although I don't like speaking behind Dr. Forbes. But I'll say what I have to say. I want to start a conversation, especially here in this community, about black liberation theology. And I want to begin this conversation by just paraphrasing a bit Jesus' words in the Gospel of Matthew 22:34, where the Pharisees ask him about the greatest commandment. And Jesus responded by saying, "Love God with all your heart, soul, and mind." And I want to say a word about what it means to love God with your mind. And we don't talk much about that. We talk about the heart, and we talk about the soul. But seldom do we talk about the mind in relation to God. And what I want to say tonight is theology is loving God with your mind. And what does that mean? Theology is the critical side of faith. It is faith questioning itself. faith challenging itself. It reminds faith, theology does, not to be too sure of itself. It reminds faith about the great contradictions in life. And nothing contradicts or challenges faith like suffering. See, faith says that God loves us. But as James Baldwin said, if God loves us so much, why are we, the blacks, cast down so far? So when faith gets happy on Sunday morning, theology meets it on Monday morning. And lets faith know that all is not so well. Now, if suffering challenges faith, no group in this land has had more faith than black people, and no group has suffered more. Coming across in the middle of the passage, auction on slave auction blocks, enslaved for 246 years, lynched, segregated for another 100 years, and having a brief civil rights movement, we still struggling. Still trying to realize the promise that America is a place for all people. But while black people have suffered and they've expressed their faith, they've only done theology a little indirectly. So theology is faith questioning, asking itself, how can we say that God loves us when we suffer so much? It was in the context of the civil rights movement, which was a movement of faith, expressing itself in the struggle for justice, symbolized with Martin Luther King Jr. as its great interpreter. But then, there was life itself challenging faith, especially in black power as articulated and preceded by Malcolm X. So it was Martin and Malcolm. Martin expressing the Christian faith, and Malcolm saying Christianity is a white man's religion, right here in Harlem. And Malcolm was so persuasive in his challenge of the Christian faith that many of us in Martin King's civil rights movement could not ignore that challenge. If Christianity is a white man's religion, how can we be black and Christian at the same time, as Reverend Ford said? That was a big question. Now, I was a Christian. Entered the ministry at the early age of 16. An interpreter and a presenter and a lover of this faith. But when I heard Malcolm, and when I heard Black Power advocates, then I asked myself, how can I bring Martin and Malcolm together? Now, Malcolm taught me how to be black. And I was black before I was anything else. So I couldn't give that up. But my mother and father and the people of Bearden, especially in Macedonia AME Church, gave me a faith that enabled me to find meaning in life, an ultimate meaning in life. But here comes Malcolm. Saying you can't be black and that too. I was determined not to give up my faith, but I could not ignore the blackness of my existence. So black liberation theology emerged in the context of the 1960s in the dialect. The contention between civil rights and black nationalism, civil rights and black power, between Martin and Malcolm. Malcolm, the black in black theology, comes from Malcolm X. If there had been no Malcolm X, no black consciousness movement, challenged the Christian faith and the civil rights movement, there would have been no black theology. King was a Negro. Yeah, he was. Read it.
That's right. That's right.
So King didn't teach me how to be black. Malcolm taught me how to be black. King taught me how to be a Christian. So the theology in black liberation theology, the theology in that phrase come from Martin King. So black liberation theology was an attempt to bring Martin and Malcolm together so that black people did not have to choose between them. But they were united in the same struggle, the yin and the yang, deep in the soul of black life. This is what black liberation theology was all about. It said that the struggle to be black, the struggle to be a Christian, the struggle for justice in this life is not alien to the Christian faith. It is the Christian faith. Only a white version and a white interpretation of that faith makes you think to be black is to be anti-Christian. To struggle for justice is to be anti-Christian. So black liberation theology, I can remember when I was wrestling with that right after the riots in Newark in July 1967 and in Detroit in July 1967, 2 weeks later, I was teaching at Adrian College in Adrian, Michigan. And when I experienced those eruptions, I said to myself, with all the theological education that I have, if I can't say a word that would empower my people to affirm their blackness and their faith, then I need to give up this theology. If theology cannot emerge out of black life and empower us to claim the humanity that God has given us, then we might as well give up that faith. Only one who has been called by the one who gave us this faith can keep us faithful to it. So that is the beginning of black liberation theology. And we'll have a chance, I hope, to talk and dialogue about it. Thank you.
Now, it is my great privilege to invite, as the next presenter, Dr. Dwight Hopkins, professor of theology at the University of Chicago Divinity School. And I would be remiss in not saying that he is a student of Dr. Cone's. So let's hear from a scholar in his own right, Dr. Hopkins.
Good evening, Harlem. It's good to be back after spending 11 years in Manhattan, being a community organizer for 5 years before Dr. Cone got me to the seminary, and the rest is history. But I've been asked to speak on the topic of doing black theology, and it seems to me to do black theology implies that black theology is found somewhere among some people and in some institutions. And so for me, there are at least three ways that black theology liberation is embodied. One, in themes in the Bible. Two, in the origin of the African-American church itself. And three, in several contemporary black churches. One, of course, is Jeremiah Wright's Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. First, the Bible. A lot of us have been doing media around the Obama, Wright, Trinity, what's happening to black people today, frenzy. And it seems to me in much of the media today, and even among many pastors today, there are questions about whether or not black theology liberation is a recent historical fad, an outmoded outcry, or even an anti-Christian ideology. I think what all these mistaken views have in common is a misread of the very Christian Bible itself. In other words, the Bible is the foundation and the substance of black theology of liberation. And for me, the fight obviously can be on whether black people are interpreting the Bible or Christian tradition correctly, but it seems to me at root it is a challenge of how we understand the Christian faith in the contemporary period. In other words, the Bible is the foundation. For example, the Hebrew Scriptures, the so-called Old Testament, is itself a story of how Yahweh God made a covenant of liberation and freedom with ancient Jews who were physically in slavery. They were physically in chains. God saw their broken bodies and decided to take a political stance by fighting against the political state of Pharaoh. And we all know the story. Yahweh defeats Pharaoh's public policy of slavery and helps the ancient Hebrews to achieve their liberation. And it is a political liberation where former slaves, with God's leadership, are freed from the power structure of Pharaoh. And then based on Yahweh's promise, these ex-slaves pursue a political goal, the establishment of their own liberated, free political state. In fact, every year, Jewish brothers and sisters celebrate Passover. This ritual reminds them that their ancestors used to be in physical slavery. and that Yahweh work with them to liberate them from Pharaoh's oppression. In addition, the establishment of the State of Israel 60 years ago shows that the Hebrew Scriptures, or so-called Old Testament, is about political liberation. And even when we turn to the Christian Scriptures of the New Testament, we see that Black theology of liberation is also a manifestation of Jesus Christ. In fact, Jesus carries out the tradition of liberation from the Old Testament. And we must remember that Jesus was not a Christian. He was a Jew. When we focus on Jesus' words as the Bible remembers them, the political aspects of Jesus' message becomes clear. But first, a clarification. There is a tendency in American Christianity to believe in polytheism. That is to say that there is more than one God in the New Testament. When these believers read the New Testament and they see the letters of Paul, they have a tendency to make Paul into another God. And so from this perspective, there are two gods. One is Jesus and the other is Paul. But I think we need to avoid polytheism in the New Testament. Paul is not a God. He is a human being who has been touched by gods. His letters have relevance and power as long as they are subordinate to the life and words of Jesus. For all Christians, the first step is to find out what Jesus says and what he did. And then Paul and everyone else in the New Testament are found in relationship to the master teacher. Of course, the question comes up, are Jesus' words and his life actually political? All agree that Jesus offered profound spiritual salvation and liberation from negative emotions and mean-spiritedness. But what about his relationship to political state power? Well, in this brief time, I'd like to touch on just two passages that indicate to me the direction of political liberation on the part of Jesus. If we look at the book of Luke in chapters 3 and 4, they show us that Jesus was baptized. Immediately following, he was tempted by the devil. Jesus overcomes all these negative temptations. And now, having been baptized and having defeated the demonic temptations, Jesus' very next move is to clarify what his mission is on earth. And here we find what many of us know is his inaugural speech or his inaugural sermon. He wants to answer the question, why has God sent him to this earth? What is his primary purpose on this earth? And in the book of Luke chapter 4, he gives one of the most famous and one of the most decisive passages in the New Testament. It indeed tells us what Jesus' mission to humankind and all creation is. There, Jesus says, his primary mission is based on his anointment from the Spirit of God, not to produce a prosperity gospel, but to bring good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the captives, to give sight to the blind, to give liberty to those who are oppressed. In addition, when Jesus pursued his primary mission, he ran into the state apparatus of Rome. And so Jesus was executed under the political authority of Rome because he would not bow down to false earthly gods. Rather, he preached that a new and higher authority had power over Rome. But still, some will say that Jesus wasn't political because he didn't engage in politics. Actually, politics is not so much defined by the people who call themselves political. What makes a person political is whether or not the state apparatus moves against them and takes them out. And so Jesus was political for at least two reasons. One, he tried to liberate poor and working class people who had been made that way by the Roman colonizers. And two, the Roman colonizers used their political power to eliminate a potential power that claimed to be greater than the Roman occupying government. And so we are simply stating that Jesus' first public statement in the book of Luke, that is to say about why he was on earth, is one of his most important speeches ever. It is this mission that sets the context and marching orders for every other New Testament figure. Otherwise, we would be promoting a form of biblical polytheism. Another one of the most important words of Jesus is found in the book of Matthew, chapter 25, verses 31 through 46. It, too, is one of the most decisive instructions from Jesus because in the 66 books of the Protestant Bible, this appears to be the only place where Jesus gives direct and clear instructions on how to get to heaven. And the purpose of all Christians is to have hope in a new life, a new reality for themselves and their children and grandchildren. This enduring hope for change is actually the beauty of the Christian religion. And so in Matthew, we find the mission for our human purpose on earth. There, Jesus says that all will reach heaven or this hopeful new life when they do the following. The criteria do not include the prosperity gospel. We will reach heaven or this longed for new life when we do the following. One, to feed the hungry, to give drink to the thirsty, to welcome the stranger, to clothe the naked, to care for the sick, and to visit those in prison. There are any criteria that talks about recruitment or even missions or whether or not you have to be a Christian. And so this great gift of the possibility of a new life and a new reality is indeed a complement to the mission that Jesus lays out in Luke chapter 4. In other words, in Matthew 25, verses 31 to 46, Jesus gives us our mission while we are on earth, and that mission complements the very same mission that God sends Jesus to perform in Luke chapter 4. And this becomes for us a political mission when we practice these criteria in a society that discriminates against poor and working class people. For example, if a political system survives by maintaining poor and working class people and other marginalized groups, then when you try to help those people, the political state will feel threatened. And if poor and working people are liberated, then the state apparatus would no longer have a source for its own privileges and accumulation of wealth. If people were to say in our society that their highest loyalty was to another kingdom or another kingdom, the political state would feel threatened. And so we can see how the doing of Black theology of liberation includes biblical themes such as liberation of the oppressed, dealing with people who are in physical chains, being faithful to Yahweh, God's promise of liberation, oppressed people using their own initiative with God to leave the political oppression of the state and move toward freedom, to follow Jesus' mission to the poor, and to see that our mission to get into heaven or a new reality is linked to the liberation and the practice of freedom of the poor. In addition to Black theology liberation being embodied in the themes from the Bible, the very origin of the Black church is another example of doing of Black liberation theology. And this point is so incredibly important because clearly the recent events in the last 2 weeks, both on the part of the media frenzy and also on some preachers who have been on cable news who have probably, there's a great confusion over the origin of the Black church, is the point I want to make. Because if we understand the origin of the Black church, we have a foundation and a plumb line to judge the adequacy of Black church witness today. The birth of the Black church in North America was itself a political movement. Africans and African Americans created their own Black religion. They combined a reinterpretation of the slave master's Christianity with their memory of African spirituality and their own everyday common sense folk wisdom. And Black religion was political because it opposed slavery, which was the official public policy of the state. So the creation of the religion was in opposition to the public policy of the government at that point. Not only was the origin of Black religion political, the origin of the Black church was political. In the South during slavery, the Black church was underground. That is why it's called the invisible institution. It was political because it was opposed to the state's slave policy, the public policy and politics of the government. Its purpose, the Black church at its founding in the South, was for the redistribution of power. We know it as the 40 Acres and a Mule movement. The Southern Black church organized against the state, and they prayed to God to redistribute political power and to set them free. And even in the North, most people see the birth of the African Methodist Episcopal Church as the beginning of the above-ground independent Black church. For example, two things happened in Philadelphia in 1787. One was the writing of the U.S. Constitution, where wealthy men wrote the Constitution to ensure their private ownership of Africans and African Americans. The Constitution refers to enslaved Africans and African Americans in three ways. One, we know, is the clause of three-fifths of a person. But the Constitution also tells all states, slave and free, that they are obligated to use force to maintain slavery. And the third reference is that it sets a date for the end of international slavery. Now, during this same year, in the same city, the seeds for the Northern Black Church were sown. At that time, Richard Allen was worshiping in the segregated section of St. George's Episcopal Methodist Church. During prayer, he was on his way back to the segregated section. In Christian churches, we all know, everyone stops immediately when prayer begins. Richard Allen stopped to pray, but happened to be in the white section. As a result, a white church official used force to remove him out of the white Christian section. Eventually, Allen and his Black colleagues formed the famous African Methodist Episcopal Church because they were fed up with the religious and state public policy of segregation. And so we began by suggesting that doing Black theology of liberation has to be embodied somewhere, some tradition, in some institution. We looked at our belief that in addition to the personal salvation and spiritual transformation that the Bible offers, both in the Old Testament and New Testament, that there is indeed a political dimension to the sacred scripture. And we talked about the importance of understanding the political foundation, among other foundations, to the black church in America. I mentioned that there would be a third example of doing black theology in addition to the Bible and the origin of the black church, and that would be Jeremiah Wright's Trinity United Church of Christ, but perhaps we will pursue that in the conversation.
We want to I was waiting for Dwight Hopkins to open that latter subject because I would bet that not all of you were in church on Sunday morning. And it's a great tribute to this conversation and what precipitated it that so many of you are out tonight. And Howard, thank you for inviting us to come together. And we know now that the subtext for our gathering is the vilification of Jeremiah Wright for telling the truth about the black experience in America. And Dwight Hopkins is, to my knowledge, the only member of the panel who is a member of that church. So you get to ask him some questions. And now, having heard from two eminent theologians, we turn to a Bible scholar. And back in the ante room here, as we waited to come, there was quite a tussle over whether we would have the theologians come first. The Bible scholar felt they should, but the theologian said the Bible came before theology. But nonetheless, we invite and it is a great privilege to have come now to address us, Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, who is a professor of New Testament at New York Theological Seminary. Dr. Hendricks.
I'm very glad to be a part of this gathering. Very thankful to Dr. Howard Dodson, my dear friend, and Ms. Clarice Razak for their hard work. And it's very timely, and I look forward to the discussion that will come from our few remarks. And I'm happy to share the stage with folks, all of whom I can say are both friends and colleagues. Dwight Hopkins, who's Dr. Cone's not just his student, but his foremost student, who's built upon Cone's work and built a very impressive and important body of work in his own right, taking black theology to new and uncharted waters. And my brothers, Drs. Butts, Forbes, and Howard, who in their various ways exemplify the ministerial practice of black theology par excellence. And finally, the passionately committed activist, thinker, and brilliant articulator of modern-day black theology himself, Dr. James Cone. I owe a personal debt of gratitude to Dr. Cone for all his work, but especially for his book, God of the Oppressed, which more than 20 years ago forever changed my way of looking at the Bible. And I was very proud to acknowledge this fact when I wrote my own book on it, The Politics of Jesus. You can't know how good that feels to be able to acknowledge someone in your own book, you see. The black theology articulated by James Cone is an extraordinary achievement. It has offered to black people a new and much healthier way of understanding the gospel, and it has filled the crucial need of black people for a mode of biblical understanding that serves our own interests, our own liberative interests. Most importantly, the capacious learning with which Cone undergirded his black theological project forced the American theological establishment to take it seriously. In other words, Cone took the best of the academy's tools in terms of theological learning and used them to the best advantage of those the Western Academy historically had most ill served. That's us, black folks. Black theology is an exercise in which elsewhere I have called guerrilla exegesis. That is, doing what works for us in ways that work for us and make sense to us, regardless of what the anal retentive archons of academic correctness have to say. I got my PhD, so I ain't. I'm a full professor, so I ain't worried. Several years ago, I ran into Jim Cohn and Dwight Hopkins at the annual meeting of the American Academy of Religion in Washington, D.C. They were getting into a cab, so we only had a few moments to chat. Those few moments were very meaningful, though, at least to me, because Jim Cohn took the time to graciously and enthusiastically congratulate me on the publication of my book, Politics of Jesus, which had just been published. He told me that he believed that my work as a biblical scholar represented the next phase of the work of theology. I don't know, and it really doesn't matter whether Jim Cohn had in mind my book in particular, or if he was just generally turning to the mode of analysis of Jesus' words and deeds through the prism of the social, political, economic particularity of Jesus' setting of life that was used in that book, and then the subsequent analysis of the tactical and strategic implications that could be drawn from Jesus' message and ministry. I don't know if that was it, but what is important is that in Jim Cohn's comment, I heard more than an affirmation. I also heard a challenge and invitation to take his work to that next level, that next phase. It's not a presumptive thing for me or anyone, I suppose, to say I'm taking it to the next step. I'm not going to say that, but this evening I am going to share just a few modest proposals for trying to build on Cohn's extraordinary achievement by trying to take that next step. Now, I admit that I offer little that is new. Essentially, what I will offer is a matter of shifting the emphasis of Cohn's work to fit the particularity of this historical moment, 3 decades after his groundbreaking work first burst on the scene. Now, one of the 5 primary sources of black theology identified by Cohn, of course, and rightly so, is the Bible. In my opinion, through most of the work of black theology, the Bible has served as a foundation and interpretive lens, rather than a strategic basis, a strategic and tactical basis for liberating action. From black people's earliest experience of Christianity in America, we've always been as Bible-centered as we were allowed to be. If the basis for teaching or a sermon wasn't convincingly based on some biblical chapter or verse about Moses or Daniel in the lion's den, or Peter or Paul, or as my grandmother called him, my Jesus, then it didn't hold much weight. Of course, that has always presented the problem of abuse of our faith in the truth of the Bible, but even abuse by white supremacists and black charlatans alike has never dampened our fervor for what we came to call the Word. What this means to me is that black people are bibliolatrists, or Bible-centered. That is to say that the final authority of our faith is not a theological concept or a sermonic flight of fancy, no matter how compelling, or some purported truth uttered in ecstatic tongues or proclaimed as a revelation from God by some self-anointed, self-appointed prophet or prophetess. No, our final authority is the Bible. And this fact is reflected in a number of ways, including, but not limited to, of course, the precipitous rise in the popularity of the so-called word churches that focus on Bible study and explication rather than utilizing the sermonic form. The readings of the text in these churches are probably wrong at least as often as they're right, and probably more often. But folks, and why do I say that? Because they don't use word churches, by and large, don't use any particular, any historical contextualization at all. They just treat the Bible, all the books of the Bible, like it's one book written by one person at one time. That's not true, and we couldn't do that. If you took letters from each of us and stapled them together, it still wouldn't make one, just one book. You'd miss the meaning, quite a few meanings there, just because there's so many different texts treated as one text. But even though these readings can often be very wrong-headed and sometimes can be really turn people off, folks cleave to these churches anyway, largely because of their hunger for biblical teaching, because it's just that great. Thus, in order to make a greater impact on black church discourse, I believe that black theology might move from principally articulating its message through the discourse of systematic theology to a greater emphasis on explicating its teachings by means of biblical chapter and verse. That includes more utilization of biblical exegeses and more study of the structural oppression, exploitation, and social marginalization with which Jesus' ministry and message were in unremitting dialogue. With greater emphasis on the Bible come several concomitant factors. The first is that the strategies and tactics Jesus taught and practiced in his quest to bring good news to the poor and structurally mistreated, they then begin to come into view. These tactics and strategies then can become a basis for action, but something more too. They can become modes of analysis and prescription. Analysis, or analytic, in the sense that gospel-centered strategic models become the standard by which we judge the social and political practices and policies of ourselves and others, especially those in power. And prescriptive in the sense that it prescribes for us the healthy, righteous, and just actions we should take and the policies we must propose and enact in order to make justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream for black people and all people. This heightened emphasis on the Bible also highlights the fact that Jesus' call to us was not to worship him or even to praise him. It was to follow him. And what he left for us to follow was not a body of doctrines and beliefs. In fact, in the Gospels, he spends very little time telling folks what to believe, and no time at all writing doctrines or delving into the kind of doctrinal obsessions that make most churches null and void when it comes to taking care of what Jesus called the least of these. Rather, the Jesus of the gospel spends almost all of his time telling us what to do, how to act, how to treat one another, that we must feed the hungry, clothe the naked, fight to free people from the shackles of punitive indebtedness and loss of shelter and livelihood. Greater emphasis on biblical exegeses and explication of the historical realities with which Jesus wrestled in his day will give black theology even a stronger basis from which to act and to propose healthy and righteous social, economic, and political policies. And, of course, we're talking about structural analysis. Oppression is structural. We're not talking about person to person. How does Paul say it? How does Ephesians say it? We wrestle not with flesh and blood. Most churches wrestle with flesh and blood, though. You don't know. We wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with principalities and powers and rulers in high places. And that's what I'm talking about by explicating the social realities, looking at the political economy and its implications and its analogies for what is going on with us today. And I'm going to tell you, many church folk really might not want that to really happen, because when you look at the religious establishment that Jesus died fighting and a whole lot of preachers in America today, you see very little difference between the chief priests and Pharisees and the Sadducees and a whole lot of folk we see on TV who have arrived in one of their two or three Bentleys. But there's one other implication of a heightened emphasis on the use of the Bible that I think is a bit more controversial, and especially in this setting. It is that when we put the emphasis of the Black Theological Project squarely on the words, deeds, tactics, and strategies of Jesus' ministry, it eventually will move beyond just the borders of Black theology to becoming, I suppose, a reclamation of the full radicality of the full gospel. One can argue that this is a universalizing move that drops the particularity of Black concerns and Black culture and Black social, economic, and political realities. Yet, by upholding the right of everyone to have life in abundance, by recognizing the integrity and worth of each human personality, it also recognizes the importance of the cultures and cultural expressions of every group of human personalities. Moreover, reclaiming Jesus' radical emphasis on love and justice, not just on justice, but love and justice, love-based justice, for all of God's children, compels us to reject and deconstruct all forms of cultural hegemony, cultural hierarchy, and cultural devaluation. When all cultures are valued equally, all persons are free to understand the message of Christ in terms of their own socio-political and social-cultural setting in life. Moving to the project of reclaiming the radicality of the gospel, the radicality of the gospel in all of its dimensions, social, political, and economic, and all the structures that that it indicts and that it supports, makes the truths explicated by Black theology, the deep and wonderful truths explicated by Black theology, available for everyone. It's available for everyone now, but there are many people who don't seem to realize that and think that focusing on the needs of Black folks somehow marginalizes other folks. If you don't believe that, just turn off Fox News. It makes available Black theology for everyone to use to look at their own situations, and removes the grounds for marginalizing the claims of Black theology as simply a Black thing with no real meaning for non-Blacks. The next step, then, the next frontier of Black theology, is, I believe, is to reclaim the political radicality of the gospel of Jesus, to dismantle all unjust principalities and powers and rulers in high places, so Black people and all people can have life abundant in every way, in every measure, in every place, today, tomorrow, and every day thereafter. Thank you.
Thank Brother Hendricks for that message for Pentecost. The true meaning of Pentecost, I might say. Now, let me welcome our next speaker, but before I do that, I'm very happy that our brother, the chief of the Schomburg, is here, Howard Dotson, because I wanted for him to be present physically before I tell y'all that we are not responsible for being an all-male panel. And I make that point. I'm anticipating from the audience. and I'm going to, because our presenters are going to talk following the presentation from our esteemed pastor, I wanted to put out a bit of my own ignorance so that they can correct me. But as I reflect on the historical trajectory of African-American religious scholarship, it seems to me that the early days were populated by men and women who studied the field of ethics in their effort to make sense of Christianity in this contradictory world that Dr. Cohn spoke about. And when they broke out in this course of study, a number of young scholars followed. James Cohn wrote his seminal work, Black Theology and Black Power, in which, by the way, he makes the point that black is not color. A whole group of brilliant young people began to study theology. And in more recent times, biblical scholarship, which, as Aubrey has said, is at the very root of our faith, now a wave of biblical scholars mastering the biblical languages and archaeology. So this full diet now we have to wrestle with in our thinking, and so indeed we are being enriched by the way this has unfolded. We are very blessed this evening to have yet another esteemed colleague, Dr. Calvin Butts, pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church, now celebrating its bicentennial. And Dr. Butts, of course, also serves as president of State University of New York at Old Westbury. Dr. Butts.
Many thanks to Dr. Howard, Dr. Dotson, to the other distinguished members of the panel, Dr. Forbes, Dr. Hopkins, Dr. Hendricks, and, of course, Dr. James H. Cohn. Doing black theology at Abyssinia, a little context. It was a burning hot summer day, burning hot in Georgia. The sun beat down on the red clay of that southern state in L.A., lovely Atlanta. And I found myself walking across the campus at Morehouse College in an altered state of consciousness. It was so hot that I didn't know where to go, where to turn. In my confusion, the only thing I could figure out was to catch a place that was air-conditioned. And the closest place was the reading room at Morehouse College. Odd, when going in the reading room, it seemed as if a long air-conditioned arm just pulled me in and sat me down. And when I sat down, I wondered what I would do. Well, I was in the reading room, read. What would I read? Because my altered state of consciousness did not really give me much clarity at all. And so I reached over and picked up a little book that was entitled Black Theology and Black Power. And I opened the book. I said, well, this seems as good as any. And I didn't put it down until I finished it. It was not a long book, but it was profoundly engaging. It helped to make clear what men like Samuel Williams, Lucius Tobin, Roswell Jackson, Melvin Watson, these were black theologians. It served to make clear to me what they'd been trying to say, and preeminent among them all was Benjamin Elijah Mays. That black people can talk about God on our own terms. We have been doing it for a long time. I often quote Maya Angelou when she says in that poem, Wings of the Morning, the Ashanti, the Aruba, the crew, arriving on a nightmare. And then she used the word very carefully, praying for a dream. Praying. Praying to who? We've been talking about God a long time. Part of our celebration and doing of black theology at the Abyssinian Church in our bicentennial year, the Council General from Ethiopia is here, was to go to Ethiopia, the oldest Christian nation in the world. These are black people talking about God in Christ. So black theology, is something that has been going on for a long time. James Cone just helped us in the context of what he described earlier to really think about it and forced many of us to go back and read, you know, John Jasper, black preacher talking about God, the sun do move. Interesting. Forced us to go back and reflect on men and women who have been talking about God based on our experience as an African people, and particularly an African people in America. This past Saturday, I gave the commencement address for St. Augustine in North Carolina, very famous black college, named after an African theologian, St. Augustine. So I wanted to say to you that we've got a long way to go in terms of understanding. And then Milana Ron Karanga helped me to understand something in listening to one of his speeches. Karanga said, I don't have to apologize to anybody. He said, I got my own struggles on which I can build my own stories. So if there was a liberation from Egypt, well, that's a great story, and I love it, love to preach about it. But there has been a liberation here in America, a story that we can tell. We have our own psalms, the spirituals. We have our own struggles. We've seen our wheel turning on the inside of a wheel. We've seen waters parted. You know, we have our own liberators, our own voices. And we don't celebrate them enough because we haven't known enough about them. Enough of you know that we couldn't even learn about ourselves. And the more we learn about ourselves, the more we learn how much we have already been talking about God. In a systematic way, that doesn't mean we reject what anybody else has said. It means that we put what they have said in the right context. That's what Dr. Cone helped me to do. And not to be ashamed of it, you know, think not... He said, go not to the Gentiles and go not to the Samaritans, but go ye to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So when God called me to ministry, he didn't send me to, you know, he sent me to black folk. Sent me to black folk. And it is in the context of the black community that I do my preaching and I do my ministry. That's not to say that what I have to say is not... good for a lot of other people to hear, but it is within this context that I've been sent. And so coming to Abyssinian, it's the only job that I've ever had in ministry. And I went there. Jim Cone wouldn't let me in the doctoral program of Union.
Don't say that. Come on now.
And I couldn't understand. I said, Doc. He said, no. He said, you want to teach? I said, no. He said, well, then you don't do it. And I thought about it for a minute. I went out and said, Dr. Proctor, what should I do? He said, don't do it. He said, wait on it. And I went into another doctoral program because of Dr. Proctor. But and there you have it. There was Samuel DeWitt Proctor, the black theologian. You know, Ron McNair was his student, the black astronaut. Jesse Lewis Jackson was his student. Douglas Wilder, the first governor, black governor of Virginia, was his student. He's doing black theology because he was talking to black folk about God and how God could work with us and make us. So I went over to Abyssinian, Lawrence Neal Jones, C. Eric Lincoln, Vincent Harding. So I went over to Abyssinian, and there was Adam Clayton Powell Jr. He'd passed away. Mr. Civil Rights. Before Martin Luther King Jr. Before Malcolm. He was a black theologian. He's a preacher. His father before him built the largest Protestant congregation in the world, the Abyssinian Baptist Church. And a most eloquent preacher, some rights not denied colored people, the colored man's contribution to religion, and when will it be made? Watch your step. These are some of the powerful sermons of Adam Clayton Powell, Sr. upon this rock. And he built a model institution in terms of a church that was committed. He was one of the founders of the NAACP. He was a participant in the Niagara movement. This is Adam Clayton Powell, Sr. So this is black theology. These are men, you know, Alexander Crummell, Henry McNeil Turner. James Cone forced me to go back and do black theology by talking to people. I didn't know them. I couldn't. They lived hundreds of years before. But by talking to them through their writing, Allen, AME Church. By reading about them and saying, what have these black people been saying about God? And all of a sudden, you begin to realize what has really been kept from us. Our first churches, we had a sense of who we were as AME, African Methodist Episcopal, AME Zion, African Methodist Episcopal Zion, First African Baptist, Abyssinian. These are all named for the continent and for specific countries. We had a sense of who we are, and we talked about it. How did we talk about it? What was the imagery we used? So, got to Abyssinian, and there was no separation of sacred and secular. Sr., and I could go back further, but let's start in the 20th century. Sr. had a concept of a church, and the church was founded based on black theology, the refusal to accept segregation in the house of God. That was black people understanding that God don't like ugly. And in that context, walk out and set up a church, not where black people only could worship God, but where all people could worship God. That's black theology. So it's not an exclusion of anybody. We're not the black church because we want to be. We're the black church because we've had to be. And so that's the doing. And it's always been committed to social justice. It was Adam Sr. During the Depression who encouraged his son to set up these soup kitchens. And it was his son, under the encouragement of his father, to go out and get involved politically. And then the father stepped back, failing health, realizing his time was up, and passed the baton on to his son. And Adam picked it up and ran with it and did theology. He was a forceful, political, social justice activist. The Powell Amendment. He would have been the first African-American president of the United States. He should have been the first African-American president of the United States. You know, they were all in Washington, D.C., in one of those back rooms. Adam slipped in because they wasn't sure whether it was a white man or a black man coming through the door. And Adam slipped in. He was a congressman at the time. They were all drinking scotch, you know, bourbon and branch water and smoking them big Cuban cigars because they can get them from Cuba then. And they were walking around and the room was filled with smoke. And the Democrats were deciding in one of these back rooms filled with smoke and scotch and bourbon who would be the next president of the United States. I'll forget about these primaries and superdelegates. They made those decisions in back rooms. And everybody was saying, well, who's got the best record? You know, who has been the most forceful? Who's the most charismatic? Who has done the most for the American people in our party? Who is our leading congressperson and senator in terms of pieces of legislation passed? And somebody said, oh, that's easy. Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. All the smoke disappeared. All the ice melted in the glass. You could hear a mouse urinate on cotton. Room got silent, and then somebody from the back said, ah, the country's not ready for a Baptist preacher. They all laughed and forgot about it. But that was black theology, because Adam was driven by God. You had to read his sermons. He's got a book, Adam Sr. We're getting Adam Sr.'s pamphlets together now for the bicentennial, but Adam Jr.'s book, Keep the Faith, collection of his sermons. You got to read some of this. That's black theology. And then Adam, in the Congress, understanding God's, Dwight put it so well, love for the poor, you know, social justice, not only used his role as chair of education and labor to pass this legislation that was beneficial not just to black Americans, but to all Americans. And then in his war on poverty, Lyndon Johnson had to acknowledge, we got the record, that Adam was really the brain and the motivating force behind that war. Harvey Act, Urban City, you know, all of that. That's Adam. Head Start. That's Adam. A black preacher. Black theology. It's the way we talk about God. We don't separate this stuff. Mm-hmm. And he made it happen. And as he was working and doing all these things, he was doing it right in the bowels of the community. He'd hold his congressional hearings on the street so y'all could see what was going on. This was Adam. This is in Harlem. Malcolm, he invited Malcolm to the church. We got the tape. You know, he wanted to hear what Malcolm had to say. This was Adam. He's mad at Martin. They had their little, you know, but that's preacher jealousy. You know. There were people in the congregation who didn't understand it. Because Adam would do strange things. He didn't always follow the party line and what all the people thought he should do. So when they thought he should go, I think it was with Adlai Stevenson, he went with Dwight Eisenhower, Republican. People scratched their head. Why is Adam doing that? Why are you going with that man? Why are you going with the Republican? But he was smart. Sometimes Adam didn't do what everybody thought he should do, what the emotionalism of the moment forced people to do and wanted him to do. Sometimes Adam went against the tide. That was the title of one of his father's books. Because he wanted to show black people, you know, I'm in the belly of the beast. I do understand some things that are going on. Trust me, because I've demonstrated there's evidence of my stewardship out here. Give me a chance. If it doesn't always work out the way we want it to work out, that's all right. And the people loved Adam because he would fight for them, doing a black theology. So here at Abyssinian, 2008, a few years, what have we tried to do? We've tried to build on that. Somebody was talking about building on, I think it was Overy talking about building on Jim Cone. We tried to build on that. So, you know, first of all, we got to recapture the community. You got to buy something. You got to own something. People got to live. People got to eat. Children have to be educated. You know, so that's what we've tried to do. Mm-hmm. That's black theology. Because that's what we believe God called us to do for the people to whom God called us to serve. So, like other churches in other states and regions around the country, you know, we built schools, houses, you know. We've developed commercial businesses, you know. We put together athletic programs. We've done the kinds of things on a not only micro level, but a macro level. We've worked with our institutions, our hospitals. And we never try to impose, you know, a one line of thought on people. We believe people in our congregations can think. Serve God with your mind, I think that's what Jim Cone said, can think. And there are a number of us who are in many different areas, many different venues, who we believe are and can work together for the benefit of the whole. You know, Jesus had a strange group that ran with him. Judas is carrying. But he kept Judas with him all the way to the end. Knowing what he was going to do. Peter was a bad motor scooter. Peter pull out that sword and go to war in a minute. In the garden, when it was not the right, you know, he cut off the brother's ear and put it back on. Jesus put it back on. It's true. He had a strange group, man. that he ran with. But that was his posse. And he understood them to the degree that he knew of their weaknesses. Well, that's the church. It's a strange gathering of folk. But it's us. And they have been trying to infiltrate it since they have been watching us do this black guy sent to Moonies.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, they
Yeah,
did.
They sent them.
Yes, they did.
And they showed you how to run your Sunday school. They bring you vans, throw you some money. Yeah. They sent them. It's an attack on the church, and it has been coming. And now it's all this talk about reconciliation. We love you, brother. Come on in the stadium, hug, and let's cry. You know? No. Why? Because the black church, and Malcolm would tell you, you know, you black and you're strong. And your strength has been demonstrated because it's been the black church that's been behind every social and political movement that has made a difference in the country. So now all of a sudden there's this cry, you know, let's all get together. Now I would say, you're too black, you're too strong, and pour a little cream in there and you weaken it up. And hold your own. And refine this talk about God. There's a practical side of theology. You got to do some things. You got to do something. It ain't all about going to heaven. Now, I want to go to heaven when I die. I make no assumptions about it. Keep praying for me. I'm a sinner saved by grace. God knows I need prayer. I need a whole lot of it. So I make no assumptions. I want to go, and I'm working every day. And I got my eye on the prize, but there's some stuff that needs to happen down here on the ground. You know, so it is about political activity. It's about voting. It's about building and saving money and investing. It's about buying property. You know, it's about organizing. It's about marching and picketing and demonstrating. It's about all of those things. And we can't stop now being distracted by somebody saying that our marching and our investing and our picketing and our protesting and our political activity is not of the Spirit. We are Holy Ghost-led, Holy Ghost-fed, Holy Ghost-bred. Everything we do is of the Spirit. And just to comment on this, the doing of black theology at Abyssinian, we've been doing it for a long time. We don't plan to stop. We're going to keep investing in our community, spreading that out, setting up models. We're going to be politically active. We're going to support candidates near and far. We're going to do all the things that we can do. And when I say support candidates, I don't mean endorse them as a church. I don't want to mess up my 501c3 income tax status. Sometimes, beloved, you know, you got to think about these things because they're always trying to hit you. You know, we're going to keep on doing these things because that's what it's about. And just one more, you know, kind of provocative statement to kind of maybe get some stuff stirred up. Jeremiah Wright. Is a brother of mine. He's a friend, been one for a long time. And I want you to know that I don't agree with everything Jeremiah said. He don't agree with everything all of us up here say. But he said they got on him about the HIV thing. Said it's a vast thing. I'm the chairman of the National Black Leadership Commission on AIDS. We got chapters all over the country. But Jeremiah just suggested that it might be possible. And why wouldn't we think that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the man put down on that piece of paper that we were three-fifths of a human being, did the pen slip? Or did he intend to write that? You know, the Tuskegee experiment, you know, did they intend to do that? Do you understand what I mean? So it is not unthinkable. And that's all he said. And I just want to, you know, the discussion of left brain, right brain, those kinds of things, we may all have different opinions about that. But at least in the context of helping us to think out of the box and consider different kinds of educational theory. I mean, that was not, you know, and then we can debate it among ourselves, trying to figure out what's the best way to help our children learn in the midst of this kind of oppressive educational system that we deal with. So listen, and I know him. I know with some of the people with whom he's worked and how he's negotiated. He's not racist. He's not parochial in terms of race. He's worked with people of all races. So in other words, for me, Jeremiah Wright has not been divisive. He is not distorted, and he is not wrong. And the prophetic ministry says, in terms of my understanding of black theology, that first of all of us are up to be criticized. And all of us have to respond, you know, in terms of some of the things we say and represent. But whoever presents him or herself as a representative of any political system is open to the scrutiny and the rhetoric of the prophetic tradition in black theology, whether it is Hillary Rodham Clinton, Clarence Thomas, or Barack Obama. Now, to that degree, beloved, those of us who represent, listen, those of us who represent that prophetic tradition in terms of black theology must not back down from that. Because at any moment, whether you be black or white, if you transgress on the forward progress of people of African descent in a way that threatens everything that has come before it, if we are silent, Jesus said, even the rocks would cry out.
I've made a judgment that it may be more productive use of our time not to tarry here with further discussion among the panelists, but to get you engaged, because I know you have had your interest heightened. I want to say it would be horrible if we missed the opportunity to build our bibliographies. I'm thinking about all the good things that we want to read that can fall from the mouths of these folks. So don't hesitate to ask about the good things, the latest things that are being written, or perhaps we'll impose don't hesitate to glean from them a list of the more recent writings that can be made available to you. I heard the AME Church mentioned quite a few times tonight, and it was it came to my mind when I heard Bishop Turner's name mentioned that according to Walton Johnson, professor of history at Rutgers, the AME Church is actually the first church founded by black people in South Africa. In South Africa. And early on, Henry McNeil Turner distinguished himself as one of the early voices against racism in that country. I'm certain you knew that if you gathered these preachers together, you would hear a lot of eloquence, and it wouldn't last 10 minutes each. Amen? But it has all been good, and I think in the spirit of the hour, we shall have now a collective dialogue, give and take. My own view is we have too often understood leadership in a solitary way, but in fact, the gifts of a pastor are often unleashed by the expectations of the people. And we may be careful sometimes about criticizing pastors who appear to be lost
and wonder whether the people's expectations may have been partially responsible. Because I see the pastors of prosperity looking out at very large congregations on Sunday morning. But as Aubrey Hendricks has alerted us, and he is an eminent scholar of the Bible, this does not have roots in the text. I believe the questions that you would like to pose have been prepared, and I'm awaiting now the delivery of those cards. So much for democracy. The other thing is that Jeremiah Wright unfortunately spoke into an audience that did not have the knowledge to understand, and it revealed once again that we do still live within the veil, because there is so much about our life, so much that is central to our life, that is not known in the country, although it can be known. Curiosity about who we are and what we know is not strong enough. That's right. Amen. Let's see. We have more cards. Now, let's try to get through this. I guess I have one that can be answered rather quickly. What color is Jesus? Anybody want to take that on? Oh, we have an answer from the audience. The color of love. That is literally the real, that's the first question. You want to try that one?
Well, I don't have a definitive answer. I can say what color he was not. If Jesus, I've seen so many depictions of Jesus, first with blue eyes. And if that had been the case, that would have been mentioned, because that would have been a real anomaly. In the Afro-Asiatic nexus there. I don't believe he looked like that. He was a Nubian brother, but he clearly was not a European. So somewhere in there was the color of Jesus, but he was not Swedish or German, and he didn't have blonde hair.
That settles that. All right. In our reflection tonight, this is, if you don't mind the chairman saying this or the moderator, this is a very good one. In our reflection tonight, the discussion was heavily focused on African-American blacks. Was there or is there a more global black theology inclusive of non-African-American blacks?
We tried to mention, Africa in terms of Ethiopia. We tried to mention St. Augustine. You couldn't talk about black theology without mentioning a more contemporary figure like Bishop Tutu. There are many, many, many more. I think one of the ones that I ran into when I was at Union that came to talk about African philosophies and religion was John S. Mbiti. So, yes, without question, there are many African theologians. I think Dr. Cohn can probably speak more intelligently than I can about who some of the others are. But theologians from Africa, theologians from the Caribbean, theologians from South America, yes, without question.
Okay, now, this is quite a substantial stack. So if you don't mind, we will... I'm going to ask that if a question seems to be more fitting to one speaker, we might ask the one speaker. This is a theological question. A question about theology. Dr. Cohn, you want to say a word about that?
Yeah, let me just say a word about black theology in other parts of the world. Black theology in South Africa emerged in 1971. And the leaders of that movement were persons who were struggling against apartheid there. One of the first essays that was written on black theology in South Africa was done by now Bishop Tutu, and the other one to really develop black theology more in South Africa was Alan Bozak, who has written several books on black theology. And you also have quite a few scholars in Latin America who are talking about, in Brazil, about black theology, and also in the Caribbeans and other places. There is an organization we call the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, founded in 1976 in Tanzania, Dar es Salaam. And members of that association come from Asia, Africa, Latin America, and also from minorities in the United States. So this is a worldwide theological movement.
Following on that, here's another interesting question. Where is black theology? Are the correspondences and inclusion to our black African religions, Ife, Yoruba, Akan, Gede, etc.?
Well, I think the issue of African religions and their relationship to black theology has always been an ongoing and a historical one, because even in the first generation of black theologians, there was a vibrant debate in terms of Dr. Cone, of course, but also Dr. Gayroy Wilmore, whose book Black Religion and Black Radicalism begins with a chapter on African religions. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are in the second generation of black theologians have taken to heart that discussion, and in fact, we look to Africa as a precedent for our black theology. And there's even a third generation of black theologians. Professor Diane Stewart, who received her PhD from Dr. James Cone, is at Candler School of Theology at Emory, and she's one of the foremost scholars precisely on this question. So if you pick up some of her work, please, articles in her book, Professor Diane Stewart, and she addresses this. So you can see that each generation builds on the previous generation, and each generation takes that risk to develop both the practice and the scholarship.
Please write down Wilmore and Stewart. We're collecting that bibliography. What was the name of the book Reverend Forbes read from tonight?
The name of the book is Coming Through the Fire, Surviving Race and Place in America by C. Eric Lincoln.
All books by C. Eric Lincoln, please. Where do you see the black church going in the next 20 years? That's an easy one. Dr. Butts?
Every time you speak of 20 years into the future, if you are a theologian and a person of God, you speak with optimism. If you run into a preacher who says, "Oh, Lord, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm scared of that," you need to get away from that preacher as fast as you can. I think that the conversations that we are having now are an indication, harbingers, of great work to come forward in the church. The young theologians who have been prepared by men like Dr. James Cone, men who are of the caliber of Dwight Hopkins and Obrey Hendricks, give you an indication of where we're going. Women, for instance, at our own church, Ebony Marshall, Violet Deese, these are strong black women who are excellent preachers and theologians in their own right. Those things give me great, another young theologian, Raphael Warnock, trained by Dr. James Cone, and now a leading pastor of Dr. King's Church, Ebenezer, in Atlanta. Otis Moss
is the third.
The third. Now the pastor of Trinity. You know, these men and women indicate that the future is bright. And then on top of that, The people, and this is the most, probably the most important, the people who fill the pews on Sunday morning. These are bright, intelligent, energetic, committed, on fire for Christ black folk. And they love the Lord, and they want to see our people and all people liberated from the oppressive political and systems and social injustice that we suffer not only in America but across the world. So I'm very optimistic about the church. I'm bullish on the church. I love the church, and I just want to stick with it as long as I can, till the people put me out, as long as I can.
Maybe I can interrupt you and ask you to respond to this question,
right,
which is relevant. How do you see black women's agency and role in birthing womanist theology in doing theology today? Can you connect
those? No, that's one for the theologians more so than myself. I'm not hedging. Well, I want to respond.
I will allow you to do that. But before you do, sir, I want to commend you for deferring a question to an expert on a given subject. I wish I could see that more on television. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dr. Howard. Now, what was the committee?
The future.
You know, I hope I'm not one of those that Calvin says needs to be avoided. I don't see a monolithic black church, and I'm very, very concerned about the future of the black church. The churches that Dr. Butts mentions are all everything he says they are, and more. But I don't know that they represent the average black church. I think there's some problems, and I don't know where it's going to take us. Quantitatively, the black church is doing well, and you know they're gaining all kinds of adherence. And qualitatively, it's less clear to me because we're seeing. This prosperity gospel is not a small phenomenon, and it's not getting smaller. And what it does, it makes folk null and void with regard to the main callings of our faith. Some of these churches, in some ways, are only churches in name because they're not doing anything but teaching individualism and selfishness. And not critiquing structures at all, just saying I don't want to change the structure. I just want to get my bigger piece of it. And then that's important. I mean that's an important part of it. But also the orient. I see too much inwardness in churches. I've been around the country a lot too, and I see a lot of inwardness. People taking pride in their institution, involved in institutional maintenance, really focused on institutional maintenance, and seeing and being wed to the church as an institution, forgetting that's supposed to be part of a movement as well. And so, I know that there are going to be areas of the church that are going to be stellar, just as Dr. Butts described. I don't know what percentage of churches that will represent, and I don't know to what extent they might actually be marginalized and fall into disrepute if people continue to go to these blasphemous churches.
Okay. I'm going to ask if we would be allowed to continue till 9:30. Will you stay with us till 9:30? Okay. Now, do you see black women's agency and role in birthing womanist theology and doing theology today?
Let me say a word about womanist theology, since I did have something to do, at least negatively, in terms of, and also positively in terms of its development. Black liberation theology began in the late 1960s, and it addressed the contradiction that white supremacy and racism raises for the Christian gospel, so that the gospel would no longer be publicly identified for black people with the people who oppress them. That was the central focus of black liberation theology, to show black people that the liberation, their liberation, is consistent, is the gospel of Jesus. Now, womanist theology began in the early 1980s. It was a response both to the patriarchy in black theology and the sexism there, but also the racism in white feminist theology. It was those two contradictions that gave birth to womanist theology. And the early voices of that theology included Jacqueline Grant, who is now teaching at the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta. She got a PhD from Union Seminary. Dolores Williams, who taught at Union, just retired a few years ago, but emerged within the context to write the classic text on womanist theology called Sisters in the Wilderness. And her use of the biblical narrative around Sarah and Hagar and Abraham created a dialogue with black theology that challenged its exclusive focus on the Exodus. Hagar was in the wilderness, and God did not liberate her. So it was that tension and that dialogue that created that text and that dialogue. Kelly Brown Douglas, also a womanist theologian. Emily Towns, teaching at Yale, a womanist theologian. So now we have more women, black women at Union Seminary than we have black men. And they are producing the kind of thinking that is challenging black theology, as well as empowering black theologians to look beyond themselves to a larger way of seeing the gospel, and not just in terms of its contradiction on race.
What about black youth in prison and black theology? Dwight, you want to try that?
Well, I know two third and maybe fourth generation black male theologians. One is a professor here in Manhattan, Mark Chapman. And he was working on prison ministry when he was a PhD student of Dr. Cone's. And I know that he's also done some writing. He hasn't written a book, but he's written some articles on that topic of black theology, youth, and prison ministry. Mark L. Chapman, who's a resource right here in New York City.
He's teaching at Fordham University.
The other person is Paul Ford, who actually grew up in Riverside Church. And now he's one of my leading PhD students at the University of Chicago Divinity School. And he's actually studying, writing, and actually working in prisons in the Chicagoland area. So there are two names. One person has written some essays, and when Paul finishes his PhD, we'll have a book, hopefully.
Yeah, let me just say, as one who is rather intimately involved in a church ministry to black youth who are in prison and coming out of prison, I think the real hope in catching the imagination and confidence of black youth in prison, who are often profoundly alienated from family and social concepts that too many of us take for granted, doing theology and seeing more churches exhibit the love of Jesus is the first order of business. I'm going to invite Howard Dotson, who has a word he wants to share with us.
Well, first of all, just again, on behalf of the Schomburg Center, I'm very, very pleased that you all are here, and we hope that something has been said or done that will be of use to you as you continue to engage questions of both this election and our own political presence in this nation over the next few decades. Two quick announcements. The first, many of the books that have been mentioned actually are in the gift shop. And if you go out and up the stairs, you'll be able to pick up copies of many of those books. And I suspect some of the authors may be around to talk with you about them or sign them. The second is that I was chastised by the chair for the absence of women on this panel. And I know it doesn't sound right, because every time that we jump on white folk, because there are no blacks there, they say you couldn't find that. Well, the truth of the matter is that we could find people, but we couldn't get them on this schedule. And so what we've decided to do is this fall we're having a forum on womenist theology with all the leading womenist scholars around. And so you all will be invited to come back and participate in that. At some point in time, when their joint schedules will work, we will have them plus these gentlemen back to have a larger conversation about the relationship between the two. Thank you.
Bill Howard, on the issue of young men in prison.
Yes.
Let me just say a word, because I think, you know, there was a... Dr. Cone talked about ontological blackness at one time. And while we are focused on black theology, I think there's a sense in which we must realize that there are some white people who do black theology and have been very instrumental in moving it forward in some practical ways. One that I'm thinking of is a clergyman named Bill Weber.
Oh, yes.
Bill had a program at the New York Theological Seminary that taught men who were incarcerated, and they received a degree out of the seminary. And one such man who came out of the seminary, a formerly incarcerated person, was Brother Eddie Ellis. And when you begin to talk about those who advocate on behalf of men and women who are incarcerated, there is no greater spokesperson than Eddie Ellis and Lonnie McLeod and a few others. So I raised that to point to a white man who would be considered doing, in one sense of the word, black theology. I point to it again to say how black theology produces advocates, revolutionary voices on behalf of young men and older men who are incarcerated, and women who are incarcerated. So I just wanted to point that out.
Of course, Ober Hendricks wanted me to underscore the very program that Dr. Butts has mentioned, New York Theological Seminary, where that program still thrives.
At Sing Sing Prison.
Within Sing Sing Prison.
Master of Professional Studies.
Exactly. Now, let's keep moving. When, where, and by whom? I think this is a pretty easy question. The expression black liberation theology was first used.
The phrase itself emerged in the context of the National Committee of Black Churchmen, which was a radical ecumenical organization responding to the rise of black power and the challenge it posed. It was about 1968 when it emerged. At the same time, I was writing Black Theology and Black Power, which became the first book on the subject, and A Black Theology of Liberation, the second book, published in 1970. But it emerged, where it emerged, I was taught first.
Mm-hmm.
and the need for a theology because we wanted to say what the Christian faith is. Theology, preachers, the sermon proclaims the faith. And you hear it every Sunday if they're doing what they're supposed to do. A theologian interprets the faith, tells you what it is for the times in which people are living. So anyone, as Dr. Buss has said, who is a minister and who is a pastor has to be a theologian. They have to know what the faith is, because if they don't know, they can't proclaim it. So a theologian is a part of the teaching ministry of the church. It tells the church what the faith is. The minister is a part of the preaching ministry of the church. You need them both. And it's because the black church often forgets about the teaching side and only emphasizes the preaching side, which is very important. But you can often hear preachers talking about the gospel and they don't know what they're talking about. So they need to study. And churches need to urge them to study. And they need to give them time to study so that they will be renewed in their thinking about the faith as they meet challenges in the world today. It is one thing to know what the gospel meant in the first century, but it's another thing when you look around in New York City and you got the Sean Bell incidents and every other kind of thing. Now, how do you take this gospel more than 2,000 years old and make it read like it's a special message for the 21st century? That's the job of the theologian. To help the preacher do that by interpreting the faith so that we can proclaim it.
I want to ask these next two questions together and invite the panel, as you would choose, to join in. One is, how can the average black pastor be careful to avoid abusing the scripture with literalism as opposed to careful textual analysis? And how does Dr. Cone's theology differ from that of Howard Thurman's, who suggests that we should emphasize, and this is the asker of the question saying this, emphasizing a more integrated church? Would James Cone agree? Now, obviously the second one, Dr. Cone, you have to address, but perhaps someone else will join in on the earlier question. I see them to be somewhat related.
As a biblical scholar, I guess there is a question that's appropriate for me. And there are a couple things. One thing is that a preacher has to have the will to know what the text says and to preach it with integrity. Now, that might sound pretty basic, but the model in too many churches these days is a performance model. And people have fun and call that church and call it spirituality. So that's the first thing. Second thing is they have to be trained. It's that simple. They have to study. Anyone who does not study is not qualified to stand up and proclaim because they don't know what they're talking about. So it's that simple. They must go to school, study with somebody, and when they preach, they must use commentaries. They have to use sources to make sure that they're not saying that they're not interpreting something in a way that's that it's not meant to be interpreted. Okay.
Yes.
You want me to say a word about the difference between Howard Thurman and me?
Yes. Yes.
I think Howard Thurman, there's no difference between Howard Thurman and me because we just did what we did at different times. Howard Thurman is mostly the first half of the 20th century and a little bit of into the second half. But I am a product of Thurman. And I remember in 1971, NCBC, this National Committee of Black Churchmen, came to New York City, and Howard Thurman was the main speaker. And I had never met Howard Thurman. And he sent for me. And, you know, when somebody sends for you that you have such high regard, you wonder what they're going to say if you are a young kid trying to do the right thing. But an elder sends for you, you don't know whether you really did it right or not. And when I walked in the room, he and his wife were sitting there. And he got up and he said to me, I want you to know that you should keep doing what you are doing. The Lord has laid God's hands on you. And he just embraced me. That was a signal to me that my calling was a little bit different from his because I was speaking about the blackness of black theology and of the gospel. But that particularity actually was the universality that Howard Thurman had preached all his life. So I'm for one world, one gospel, one people. I just wish some other people would act like we are one people.
That sound eerily like the debate going on in this community a few years back about the particular versus the universal during the so-called Harlem Renaissance. And I can tell you that people who claim to embrace the universal before they embrace the particular worry me. The Bible says, love your neighbor as yourself. There is a presumption first that you love yourself. We have so many good questions here, and we have such wonderful people present. We have too few opportunities to be with them. Listen at this one. When speaking about black liberation theology, it is always assumed that the political liberation is the only objective that must be realized. However, in South Africa at least, we have come to realize that unless there is equal stress placed on economic and cultural liberation, black theology becomes simply an intellectual exercise. Unless you are no more dependent on others, in South Africa's case, whites, you can only practice your black liberation theology in your church and in your house. Wow. Now, Dwight, hit that a little bit.
Okay. I think the other good doctors have already touched on the Dr. Butts mentioned in how doing theology was, black theology was being done at Abyssinia. He mentioned economics. He mentioned investment and accumulation of capital. That's economics. He talked about supporting the political process, the electoral politic process. That's politics. He also talked about the whole idea of Abyssinia, Ethiopia. So that's the cultural part, if not the Pan-African part of black theology. I think black theology liberation has to be effective if it does do a couple of things. One, it does have to talk about politics, because for me, politics is the ability to redistribute power. It has to talk about economics, because for me, economics is the ability to redistribute wealth. And it has to talk about culture because culture is a redistribution of our understanding of the aesthetic. And so black theology itself is a comprehensive, holistic approach to reality and how the gospel message informs that reality, particularly from the point of the poor and the oppressed. And many of us, as Dr. Cullen mentioned, that in South Africa, black theology and USA black theology have a long history of collaboration. In fact, Steve Biko, in his book, I Write What I Like by Steve Biko, talked about how the black consciousness movement back in 1970 and 71 in South Africa clandestinely read Jim Cone's book, Black Theology and Black Power. So there's a direct relation between black theology and the black church USA in the contemporary period and the holistic economic, political, and cultural movement in South Africa through Cone and Steve Biko.
Beautiful. Can anyone on the panel explain the expression or the explosion of prosperity gospel, particularly in the black church? Is there a connection with American consumerist culture and the growth of the prosperity gospel?
Materialism is the South African bishop, I believe, said this, the unconscious missionary faith of the West. It's it's so powerful in its use of media and its play on narcissism and egotism that it appeals to the base instincts of humanity, black or white. So if you tell somebody in a capitalist society especially that they're going to make more money, that they're going to have all the bells and whistles and trinkets and cars and all those kinds of things that a consumerist society and a materialist society can offer, they're going to go for it. And the deceiver of our brothers and sisters, the great deceiver, the prince of this world, is playing a game on us, is tricking us, and is luring us away. And the only way, and this is just pure Bible here, you know, the only way we can break that is by the testimony that we share with the rest of the world. We have to overcome the arch deceiver with our testimony, and that is our preaching, and it is informed by the teaching. The gospel has to be preached. Jesus eschewed materialism. He walked away from it. He told the rich young ruler, if you want to come follow me, you got to go sell all you got, baby. And the man said, I can't do that. So I think that that's the reason. It is we are railing against a spiritual wickedness that is rooted in high places. And that's why I believe the Bible says that only a few of us will get it. And it's subtle. It's not only the prosperity folk who are purveyors and endangered by this. It's all of us. It's all of us. It's me, it's you out there. Because our survival compels us to be tied up so deeply in the material. And even the practical notion that I've talked about earlier, see, because I'll tell you, I'm a sinner. I need prayer and I need help. And I never claim to, you know, I'm saved by grace, not by works. And but it is so when you see people without housing, and you see people who are hungry, and you see people who are naked, your first impulse is to do right. But you don't want to do it for the wrong reason. And often we do and feel good about what we're doing, but we're really not helping to break the back of the spiritual evil that's destroying us fully. And that's tough to deal with, but that's the way the devil operates. And, please help me.
I knew this time would come, Dr. Forbes. I never imagined it would mean that I would have to say no to you. And so, go ahead.
Two things. Reinhold Niebuhr, who taught at Union, said that at the heart of human sinfulness is our unwillingness to accept the security which God offers. Therefore, we go about creating our own security blanket. Race is one of the things that offers security to some people, and the other is money. Then Jesus said that you cannot serve God and mammon. So since the founding of the United States of America, in the development of its capitalist ideology and economics, we have been tracing the plebiscites ever since. You can't serve God and money at the same time. On the basis of the exit polls from the contests and elections since the founding of this nation, it is now possible to project in the contest between God and mammon in America that the winner is mammon. Therefore, prosperity theology actually responds to the ruling deity in America. And I think the issue has to be that black theology, when it deals with class, has to always remind people that if you decide to be a Christian, you have to give up serving mammon, but become a person committed to some values so that money can serve those values. And if you're in South Africa and you are liberated politically and you do not have enough money to support the new political agenda, you have only one half of your liberation. So the tempting nature of prosperity theology is it takes a half-truth and makes that half-truth the ultimate truth. Therefore, it is based on the fundamental lie. The full truth would be that Jesus came that you would be able to have abundant life. Abundance is measured by love as well as subsistence necessity, as well as the power of self-determination. And what I think has often been called the full gospel was half the gospel. And black liberation, when it is full, will manage to deal with individual and corporate and collective economic, political, social, and culture. And I think that's the growth edge that Aubrey is talking about.
Excellent. Now, we are coming. I'm going to ask you to hold tight. We are coming to a close. I promise not to keep you beyond the appointed hour. But these are two vitally important questions. And I think the first one has been answered. I just want to respect the question. There are many good questions that will not be answered tonight, as you certainly can appreciate. But I believe the question, who are some of the female forerunners of black liberation theology and their works? I would like to study some of those works along with James Cone et al. Do you think you've touched upon that, the questioner? Did you get... You got some of that? Yes. The question was written before the answer, so
Dr.
I think...
Dr. Howard, we just want to also include Katie Cannon.
Katie Cannon. At Temple, is it? No?
At Union Theological Seminary Presbyterian Church in Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond, Virginia. Dr. Katie Cannon, Union Theological Seminary at Richmond, Virginia. Now, this one is also tangentially on the same subject. And if I may, because she has included her name, and I've heard it mentioned tonight, Reverend Ebony Marshall is asking this question, the disclaimer notwithstanding about the absence of the substantial contribution of womanist theologians and theoethicists, what does liberation look like in relation to the intra-constructs of oppression that exist within the context of the black church? Or does the inter-dialogue with whiteness continue to supersede how we make justice amongst ourselves? Whoa. Now, I want to ask each speaker, because that's the last question of the night, to just hit that because of its vital nature. Everyone have a word on that one. everyone is invited, not required.
I think that's a very important question, because you're not going to have a liberation that challenges the larger society unless you are liberated within the community that is being oppressed. Indeed, what I would say is that we need all of the live human beings we have in our community in order for us to become what God has created us to be. So womanist theology is not something that of a challenge that we need to worry about. It is a challenge that we need to encourage, and also one that we need to encourage and to make sure that the next time we have a panel like this is that we could actually use Ebony Marshall, could have been here, because she herself is doing a PhD at Union right now.
Ebony, where? Is Ebony here? Wave your hand. Stand up. Let us see you. Yes. Thank you, Ebony. Now, I'm going to be the one to answer the last question. How do we educate the news media? So hold on now. After each speaker, I'm going to answer this question. All right? Dr. Hendricks.
There's one other thing with regard to women, and that is, again, and this is where the importance of biblical scholarship comes in. There are some places in the Bible that say that women should be quiet, that they should be subservient. Now, I'm talking about the New Testament. And without proper training to understand how to contextualize some of these statements, and also to see how they contradict the spirit of the rest of the New Testament, there will always be people who will be enthralled to those biblical sayings. And so it's not just the attitudes of men that are the problem, but it's also that it is in the biblical witness. Now, there's a way to see that it has to be set aside and should not influence anyone's outlook on gender roles in the church, but that comes from study. And pastors, and we're talking about 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus in particular. I'm just going to say this, and I'm through. Anyone who uses those texts, which were not written by Paul, clearly, and we don't know who wrote them, who uses those texts to exclude women from the teaching ministry or the preaching ministry, should be invited to go back to school and learn a little more biblical study, so they will see that that is not what they can do or should do.
Thank you. Good answer. Brother Dwight? Dwight, do you want to speak on that?
Yes. I think one of the major contributions that womanist theologians and preachers have done is to push us on how different forms of the positive dimensions of our relationship with God and the negative attacks on our relationship with human beings. For example, they have talked about that not only should we talk about race, gender, sexual orientation, the ecology, et cetera. And I think what they push us even at a more deep level is this mean spiritness, this evil prince that Dr. Butts talks about. And more just, you know, clear terms, is basically a question of power and control that underlies all these isms. There's a basic issue of how can I control someone else individually, have power over them, or how do I control groups of people or classes of people and have power over them? And until we get at that root level, it seems to me, then we will only be chipping away at one of the isms, as opposed to, as the womanists have taught us, that they're all interconnected. And there's a way of getting at that. And so that's why the womanists, to me, have made a major contribution to the whole discussion of black theology. In fact, Christianity in general, not just to one area.
I think that in regards to liberation as it functions in the church, we need to do some study about God, because if your God is a hierarchical deity who exercises oppressive power over you, then when you get to be either a pastor or a deacon, you will seek to model that pattern and exercise lordship over other people. But Jesus says that the religion he was talking about wasn't going to do that. So it becomes very important for us to go back and reconceive of what kind of God we have. And let's ask the question, to what extent is God as committed to our freedom as God is to our righteousness? And if God had to actually handcuff us to make us righteous, would that be satisfactory to God? Because the nature of God's love is that, does God coerce our love, or does God woo our love, leaving us free to reject it? The question would God rather, as it were, arrest us and take us to hell, to heaven, or free us and let us go to hell if we want to? You got to think about all of that.
I want to ask everybody to settle in, because I want to try to start something regarding Ebony Marshall. Ebony Marshall and Violet Deese. Violet Deese is the first woman to be the assistant pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in its 200-year history. My response is they both work for God at Abyssinian. So, you know, there's a practical thing that's at work here. If you really believe in womenist theologians and women in ministry, you got to hire them in the churches, you know. And so that's one answer. Now, I do know this, and I'm pressing my brother Bill Howard on this. But Dwight had a third point, or fourth point, and he wanted to tell us about the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. And I think that we need to hear from him on that. He's a member of the church. Again, I say that Jeremiah Wright is one of those preachers who has been forthright in the declaration of what I might call an expression of black liberation theology. And while, again, nobody agrees with everything any of us have to say, I do believe that if he is not put in context in terms of what we're talking about today, we will have done a disservice to all of those who gathered. And people wonder, you know, and I know, and I say this, I know the strong emotional connection that many in our community have to the candidacy of Barack Obama. I know that. And I know how many of us were shaken by the division, that seeming division, or whatever it is, that seems to exist between Jeremiah and Barack, that we believe is forced by media. And we need to talk about that just a little bit tonight. I was one who said we didn't, but I know if we go out of here, we're going to have to answer all kinds of questions. So I think Dwight can help us. He helped me by listening to him as I could see him across the television. But I think he can help us just a little, Bill, if we spend just a little time hearing him unfold that.
Do you concur? Truth is, if it hadn't been for Jeremiah Wright, we wouldn't be here. I think that's right. And I'm going to answer that famous question, and I'm going to ask Dwight to respond to Dr. Butz's challenge, his invitation. I want to respond to the question because it's an introduction to Dwight. And after Dwight speaks, I'm going to ask Dr. Forbes if he would dismiss us for the evening. But the question is, how do we educate the news media? And I'm going to tell you the answer. You ready? You can take a hog to the trough, but you can't make him drink.
I think the Jeremiah Wright affair, some have named it, teaches us some very important lessons for us as a community, particularly Harlem being one of, if not the leading black community in the country, and also as Americans in this time and space of North America. One is what we've been hinting at here, that the Jeremiah Wright affair actually challenges us to go back to look at what Christianity is itself. Because Christianity in the United States, particularly in the last 7.5 years, have been hijacked by these prosperity gospel preachers. And not only are they growing because our people hunger for prosperity, because the economic situation is worse off than it was prior to the Civil Rights Movement, read the National Urban League urban reports every year, but it's also this prosperity gospel has been fed by the Bush administration. So it's a conscious attempt to hijack not only the prophetic wing of the black church, but what is the true nature of Christianity. So it's a larger issue. Two, I think that so-called Jeremiah Wright affair is teaching us that it's something that Angela Davis said and Martin Niemöller said in Germany, if they come for me in the night, they're going to come for you in the daytime. And so I'll give you a great example. Reverend James Meeks, who's also on the south side of Chicago, after the Fox and other media started to attack Trinity and Jeremiah Wright, Fox News secretly went and got tapes of Reverend Jeremiah of James Meeks. And he had said the N-word in one of his sermons, so they publicized that locally. So he did a public apology and said he will no longer use the N-word in his pulpit. So the lesson there is that they're going to come. They start at somebody, and then they come at the rest of us. The other thing it teaches us is that we should not allow, I think Dr. Butts and others have hinted at it, we should not allow the media to determine what's inside the family. They tried to do that with Marcus Garvey and W.B. Du Bois. They tried to do it with Malcolm and Martin. And now they're trying to do the same thing. So we at Trinity have these buttons that have that famous picture of Barack's hand around Reverend Wright. And at the top of the button, it says, God is pleased with both. And Reverend Otis Moss preached a sermon last Sunday saying exactly that, God is pleased with both. And ultimately, it says to me that no matter who's elected, that the issue is it's the leadership of the black church that's going to impact the soul of America. That was the motto and still is of SCLC. That, and Barack is correct on this, is the people from below that determine history. Because we know that when he's sworn in January of 2009, that the people's movement from below, led by the black church, has got to keep him accountable.
That's right.
Because he is going to be, he's going to be attacked, he's going to be seduced, he's going to be all kinds of ways to move from that agenda of the people's movement. So there's always a role for the black church. For us to, you know, help mobilize the people, help engage the people, and build on this movement that he's tapping into. But we cannot rely on any individual or any party except for God's party. And one of the best expressions of that to me is still the prophetic wing of the Christianity of America, and that is the black church.
You have been very patient tonight. Dr. Dotson, thank you so very much for opening the doors.
We got to go. There's just a whole stack of questions, darling, and we need to respect the people, other people, whose questions will not be asked, and I'm going to defer now to Dr. Forbes.
And what a joy to be associated with this panel tonight. Dr. Cohn, when he spoke at Howard that day in 1970, sent me back home preaching a different way. So I want to send you out. He talks about loving God with the mind. I want to assign you a theological problem to go home with. And this is it. In the book of Revelation, there's a chapter that says, there's a verse in the third chapter when the letter is to the church at Laodicea. It says, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man or woman hear my voice and open the door, I will come in and sup with him or her. And then it says, whoever conquers, they shall sit with me. And blessed are they who have ears to hear what the Spirit says to the church. This is your theological assignment, your black theological liberationist assignment. First of all, is anybody knocking at your door? That is, at the door of your heart? Who is it that's knocking at your door, trying to engage you in conversation about what really matters in your life? And the next question, behold, I stand at the door. That is the door of your soul, your nefesh, your very being. Now, if you are not home, that is, at home with honesty about who you are and what your life's experiences have been, the whoever it is that's knocking will find you at somebody else's house and you're going to miss the visit. So I want to ask you, what would it mean to be so honest with what your life's experiences have been that you are living in your real house? I mean, the house you really live in, and you are able to hear the knocking. Now, this is the other thing. Said, if you open the door, what does opening the door to ultimate reality mean? What does opening the door to love, to justice, to peace, to honesty, to integrity, what does that mean? Well, you must understand that the Lord God, or love, whether you're humanist or theist, whatever it is not going to knock your door down. If you are without power, you don't have a door. You don't have a house. Ain't nowhere for them to knock. So I'm putting the economic piece back in there. You got to think about that. Then the next question is, he says, if you open the door, I will come in and sup with you. That's what theology is. It is when the ultimate comes into your house. And by the way, how does your house look? And what are y'all serving up in there? And you can't, well, you want to send out to Kentucky Fried, but get what are you putting on the table? That's what he's going to help eat. If you eat it, he's going to eat it with you. Theology is Jesus from the Christian perspective, and whoever your deity may be, what y'all sup. And you understand that when the brother comes in to sup, he's not just going to eat. They're going to be talking. What y'all going to talk about? What really matters to you? Where are you coming from? What are your doubts? What are your fears? What are you concerned about? What would you wish to help you to fulfill your dreams? Then he says, the one that conquers, you will sit with me, meaning a continuing exploration of the meaning of life. And then it says, blessed are they that have ears to hear what the Spirit has to say to the church. If you black, and you ain't at your black house, but your black truth and your black experience and your black expression, it's going to be a very testy time of suffering. And if you white, God knows he's not going to knock at a black door for you. He's going to knock at your white door. But it could have a black side if it has to do with struggle with the vicissitudes of life and the vulnerability of life. So I want you all to go home and be a Jim Cone scholar and be your black self when the door is knocked on. And I want you to talk about what really matters to you and dare to believe that if Jesus respects you, he's not going to talk to you primarily about somebody else's problem. He's going to deal with yours. And when you come back together with each other, tell each other what you and Jesus talked about. That'll be black theology. And I think it's liberating too, because when Jesus sits at the table with you, or Muhammad, or Confucius, or the Buddha, if it's genuine, it'll be just like that black talk, because there is a commonality. We may look different, but life itself has its blackness. Out of the blackness, Thurman says, there is a luminous darkness that a light comes out of it. That's about the way I want to send you all home. And to conquer means you get over yourself, you get over your nationalism, your narrowness, and you just enjoying Jesus so much, until you become a window through which God reveals the nature of ultimate reality. Enjoy your theology.